In his bars and brothels, he was supplying high-priced, high-margin goods and services to a market where demand was virtually unlimited. And unlike his oil supply business, where he constantly had to suffer the depredations of bigger fish like the Standard Oil Company, his drinking, gambling, and prostitution establishments had no larger players to compete with. Storyville, in short, was a small businessman's dream, and Tom Anderson was doing everything in his power to take advantage of it. So, too, were many others in New Orleans' sporting world, for there was plenty of business in Storyville to go around. Vice had always been lucrative in New Orleans, but in this new era of official tolerance, the profits to be made were growing. Yes, beat cops still had to be paid off for their genial blindness to minor infractions, but the weekly douceurs, left discreetly in the boxes gracing every brothel's front porch, were not nearly as onerous as they once were. Now able to operate with impunity on the sunny side of the law, scores of vice entrepreneurs, both male and female, were turning Storyville into a virtual supermarket of sin, catering to appetites and pocketbooks at all points on the socioeconomic scale. The new district, in fact, was laid out almost as rationally as the D.H. Holmes department store on nearby Canal Street. Each of the six major cross streets of Storyville specialized in its own portion of the market. Basin Street, the broad avenue that anchored the foot of the district, closest to the Vieux-Carré and the river, was the place for the luxury trade. Here was the already famous row of large mansions, hosting the so-called $5 houses. These brothels, elaborately decorated and aspiring to an air of opulent exclusivity, were the ones specializing in the white and octoroon beauties most relentlessly touted in the blue books. They were the refined sporting houses, aimed at a white clientele of certain means. One block behind Basin was Franklin Street, a decidedly less high-toned thoroughfare of smaller brothels, along with many of the dance halls, honky-tonks, and saloons that would soon give the district its reputation as a center for music as well as for sex. Extending back from there, in roughly descending order of refinement and expense, were Liberty, Marais, Villery, and finally Robertson Street, home of countless saloons, cafes, and brothels of low and lower repute. On these streets, and on the four intersecting thoroughfares of Custom House, Bienville, Conti, and St. Louis, were also the notorious lines of cribs, tawdry one-room shacks rented by the day by the Tenderloin's rougher class of prostitutes. Standing half-clothed, or sometimes even naked, in doorways, the mostly white women of Liberty and Marais and the mostly black women of Villery and Robertson would advertise their wares in the most forthright way imaginable, for whatever price the market would bear. These back streets of Storyville were also the home of a few black brothels, the only sex establishments available to African-American patrons outside of those in the unofficial black Storyville, located on the other side of Canal Street. And so, here, within the boundaries delineated by respectable New Orleans, disrespectable New Orleans flourished. Of course, prostitution and vice did not cease to exist beyond the borders of Storyville. In fact, in 1902, the Daily Item would launch a campaign to eliminate the vice establishments that doggedly continued to operate elsewhere in the city. Nor did the geographic containment do much to mitigate the inherent noxious and abusive elements of that way of life. The rampant drunkenness and violence, the dissipation, the corruption of underage girls, and sometimes boys, forced into a way of life they cannot have chosen freely. The exchange of loveless sex for money, after all, carries with it an ethos that no amount of velvet, champagne, and gold leaf can make any less degrading. But Storyville was an attempt, at least, to forge a compromise between human ideals and human nature, to rationalize the inevitable and alleviate the harm of activities that realistically could not be abolished. Or so the city's progressive reformers believed, at least for a time. Meanwhile, until that time passed, there were many who took full advantage of the opportunity to make a lucrative living off the experiment, not just worldly men like Tom Anderson, but many women as well. Prostitution had traditionally been one of the few alternatives for working-class and lower-middle-class women to a life of drudgery in factories or domestic service. In the permissive environment of Storyville, these women could now make real money without actually breaking the law. And make money they did, particularly the elite core of Basin Street madams. Josie Arlington, for instance, was doing very well indeed at her new brothel at 225 Basin Street, just a few doors down from her business partner Anderson's annex. Having purchased the large and spacious mansion back when the boundaries of Storyville were first decided, she had allowed her consort, Tom Brady, to oversee its renovation into a showplace of late Victorian opulence. With its domed cupola and canopied balconies, the four-story facade exuded just the kind of ostentatious respectability she had begun aspiring to in the 90s, after her split with Philip Lebrano. The interior, decorated with leather furniture, ornate tapestries, and oriental statuary, was a perfect expression of Gilded Age excess, featuring one hall, the Mirror Maze Room, paneled entirely in mirrors, a music room, and individual parlors done up in Turkish, Japanese, Viennese, and American styles. Upstairs were 16 bedrooms, each dominated by a large brass bed, where Arlington's exclusive roster of beautiful women could entertain their customers. It was, according to the Blue Book, absolutely and unquestionably the most decorative and costly fitted-out sporting palace ever placed before the American public. And as a generator of revenue, Josie Arlington's was nonpareil. The take from those 16 bedrooms, combined with wine and liquor sales in the parlors and the percentage from the house's gambling business, amounted to a substantial weekly profit for the establishment's two principals, and all of this now came with little threat of the kind of arbitrary police raids that had previously cut so heavily into vice industry earnings. But Anderson and Arlington were hardly the only entrepreneurs making good on Basin Street. The two blocks between Custom House and the edge of the St. Louis Cemetery No. 1 on Conti were teeming with similar establishments, all operating under the aegis of a female entrepreneur and all competing for the higher-end segment of the market. "These places were really something to see," pianist Clarence Williams would later say of the Basin Street houses. "They had the most beautiful parlors, with cut glass and draperies and rugs and expensive furniture. They were just like millionaires' houses." And the women on offer in these palaces were, at least to impressionable eyes, as elegant and refined as the furnishings. "The girls would come down dressed in the finest of evening gowns, just like they were going to the opera. They were just beautiful. Their hairdos were just so, and I'm telling you that Ziegfeld didn't have any more beautiful women than those. Some of them looked Spanish, and some were Creoles, some brown skins, some chocolate brown, but they all had to have that figure." That so many of the prostitutes on Basin Street were mixed race was one of the district's great paradoxes. The rest of New Orleans may have been subject to the hardening Jim Crow regimen of strict black-white separation, but in Storyville, for the right price, white men could relive the fantasy of the city's more racially fluid past. No blacks were allowed into the Basin Street brothels as customers, and darker-skinned black prostitutes were largely confined to the back streets of the district. But sexual contact across the color line was not only tolerated here, it was actively promoted, at least in the district's first years. Early Storyville, in fact, was arguably the most racially integrated square mile in the entire American South. Two of the finest houses on Basin Street made a particular specialty of interracial sex. Mahogany Hall, an elaborate iron-balconied mansion at 235 Basin, just two doors down from Josie Arlington's, was the fiefdom of Lulu White, a legendary madam whose so-called stable of octoroon beauties soon became one of the Tenderloin's biggest attractions. Lulu White herself, who advertised as an octoroon, but who was, by most reports, substantially darker skinned than that label would imply, came from mysterious origins. Depending on the source of the story, she was born in 1864 or 1868, either in Cuba, Jamaica, or, most likely, on a plantation in rural Alabama. What's known for sure is that she was already well established in the New Orleans vice world by the late 1880s. Often in trouble with the law, she was arrested frequently through the 80s and 90s, but somehow rarely served time in jail, thanks to the influence of some wealthy patrons. It was those same wealthy patrons, connected with the local Democratic ring, who assisted her financially when, shortly after the creation of Storyville, she sought to build a brand new establishment on Basin Street. White raised the existing structure on the site and spent a small fortune creating a showpiece, a 4-story brick palace with 5 parlors, one of them, like Josie Arlington's, paneled entirely in mirrors, numerous boudoirs, each with a private bath, cut-glass chandeliers, and an ornate elevator built for two. The furniture alone was said to cost over $2,000. And here at Mahogany Hall, Miss Lulu White held court, always bedecked in a formal gown, a bright red wig, and so many diamonds that she was said to rival the lights of the St. Louis Exposition. A figure of exaggerated flamboyance, White was supposedly a model for the screen persona of actress Mae West, she insisted that no luxury was too great for the patrons of her house, where, as Louis Armstrong later recalled, the champagne would flow like water. Given the treatment afforded most people of color in 1900s New Orleans, Lulu White's success and status within the confines of the district was nothing less than astonishing. Nor was it unique. Faux refinements may have been the stock in trade of all the Basin Street madams, their genteel, high society affectations offered up with an ironic wink and a knowing leer. But the madam who played the role most convincingly was Willie V. Piazza. Also self-described as an octoroon, Piazza was one who, by general consensus, could credibly passer pour blanc. Though she called herself a countess, Piazza was apparently the daughter of an illiterate woman of color, possibly a former slave, and a first-generation Italian hotel keeper from Copiah County, Mississippi, the place where Robert Charles had grown up. The countess, according to popular lore, was a sophisticated, well-read woman who spoke several languages fluently, smoked Russian cigarettes in a long, jewel-studded holder, and wore a monocle offset by an expensive diamond choker. How she had acquired her education, her brothel at 317 Basin boasted an extensive library of literature in several languages, remains a mystery, but one that her patrons were apparently disinclined to look into very closely. A woman of discerning musical tastes, she reportedly slept on a mattress embedded with a music box. She also furnished her brothel's parlor with a perfectly tuned white grand piano, on which only the finest musicians were allowed to play. She was something of a fashion icon, too. Her finely styled outfits, and those of her house's ladies, reportedly the most handsome and intelligent octoroons in the United States, were carefully studied by local dressmakers, allegedly to be copied for the ensembles of customers belonging to the city's better half. But luxury houses like those of Piazza, Lulu White, and Josie Arlington accounted for only a portion of the new economy brought about by the creation of Storyville. By the time Tom Anderson's Annex opened in 1901, there were already an estimated 1,500 prostitutes of all kinds operating in the district, with perhaps 500 more imported seasonally for the high tourist traffic in winter. These 2,000 women and the subsidiary businesses that their activities supported, the bars, gambling houses, dance halls, restaurants, honky-tonks, and other entertainment establishments of the district, provided work and profits to a large and varied population of New Orleanians, from pimps to chambermaids, from musicians to cab drivers and bartenders. In the eyes of the progressive reformers who had created Storyville, then, the experiment seemed to be working. The city's ineradicable vice industry had, to an extent, been isolated and rationalized. And while the reformers did not exactly approve of the goings-on in Storyville, though some of them profited from it as landlords of property in the district, they could at least content themselves that a framework had been built by which respectable and disrespectable New Orleans could peacefully coexist. While not entirely out of sight or mind, sin in the Crescent City was at least on the way to being contained. From the perspective of those who did business in the district, on the other hand, the experiment was a smashing success. Big money was being made, not just by corporations or old money elites, but by individual entrepreneurs of a lesser class. And for Tom Anderson in particular, who was now in a position, if not to reverse the positions of good and evil, at least to ensure that the denizens of Storyville had a voice in the state legislature, the future was bright indeed. Even the Storyville mayor's personal life had taken a turn for the better. Sometime before the advent of the district in 1898, Tom had taken up with a lovely young woman from Kansas named Olive Noble. She, too, was a prostitute, working under the professional name Ollie Russell, but she was soon styling herself as Mrs. Anderson and setting up housekeeping in the apartment above her husband's Arlington restaurant on Rampart. Of course, there were difficulties, not least of which was the other Mrs. Anderson, whom Tom had not yet been able to divorce. And while apparently quite enamored of his new concubine, who was 17 years his junior, the mayor of Storyville was not above straying occasionally with his other constituents. Ironically, these two problems managed to work each other out. One night, after hearing that Anderson had been consorting with another woman, Ollie confronted him in the bar of the Arlington restaurant. She ended up taking a shot at him with a small pistol, though somehow managed only to shoot herself in the foot. Even so, the misadventure ultimately redounded to her favor. The foot wound turned out to be minor, and the incident apparently gave the real Mrs. Anderson the solid grounds she needed for a favorable divorce settlement. Naming Ollie Russell as co-respondent and citing the shooting episode as evidence of infidelity, Kate Anderson proceeded to launch her own divorce suit. This time, the divorce was granted, on highly favorable terms to her. And when it became official in 1899, Tom Anderson, though somewhat poorer, became free to marry his true love, that is, Ollie herself, eager to become the third Mrs. Anderson. It didn't happen, at least not for a while. The death of Tom's beloved mother intervened in January 1900. Anderson was left with the problem of what to do with his now 20-year-old daughter, Irene, who had come to live with him and his mother 4 years earlier after her graduation from the convent school. Tom couldn't leave Irene alone in the house on Canal Street, nor could he, with good conscience, expect her to live with him and his ex-prostitute wife. But here again, a fortuitous solution presented itself. In late 1900, he introduced Irene to George Delsa, a bartender at his Arlington restaurant. The two apparently liked each other immediately and were soon engaged to be married. When that wedding occurred in 1902, with Tom dressed in his best tuxedo to give away the bride, the difficulties with his personal life seemed to be past. He and Ollie could finally live what he himself called a life of ideal bliss, free of complications. After the heartbreak of losing the beloved wife of his 20s and the anguish of disassociating himself from the hated wife of his 30s, he was apparently entering his 40s in a state of domestic and professional hopefulness. And the fact that his brand of respectability was not identical with that of the Daily Picayune or the denizens of the Pickwick and Boston clubs, that seemed not to trouble him at all. But to at least one member of the Storyville aristocracy, the Basin Street version of respectability was not enough. For Josie Arlington, the so-called queen of the demimonde, the yearnings for legitimacy and Victorian standards of propriety had, if anything, grown even more acute since the creation of Storyville. Granted, she was making money on Basin Street, lots of money, and it was said that she, unlike many other madams, had at least some rules about what kind of behavior could take place in her house. "I'll never have a girl ruined under my roof," she once allegedly said, explaining why she would never hire a virgin as a prostitute. But she still had designs on a more normal life as a wife and mother. And she was determined to realize those designs, in one form or another, in the person of Anna Dubler, her brother Henry's young daughter. By all accounts, Josie's relationship to Anna was one of complete devotion. Josie was in love with Anna, one friend later said. In conversation, there was hardly any other topic but Anna. Anna was her whole pleasure in life. The girl was 17 years old in 1901, yet somehow Josie and Tom Brady, known to her as Aunt Mary and Uncle Tom, had kept her entirely in the dark about the family's source of income. Josie, who lived mainly at the Basin Street brothel, paid rent for her brother and his family to occupy a home in Carrollton, safely distant from Storyville. In this way, she hoped, like the reformers, to draw a boundary around her life of sin, keeping her dear Anna safe on the other side. But now that the girl was getting older, her aunt feared that Anna might eventually discover the true identity of Aunt Mary. And so, Josie arranged for Anna to go to a convent school 1,000 miles from Basin Street, at St. Joseph's Academy in Emmitsburg, Maryland. Her motive was plain. According to one friend, she didn't want her niece to know what life Mary Dubler was leading. So, while Arlington herself may have been ineradicably sullied by the life of Storyville, she was determined to keep her beloved niece pure and untouched by it. Anna, it seems, was to be Josie's surrogate in the respectable world to which she herself could never truly belong. The arrangement proved satisfactory for about a year. Anna happily pursued her studies at St. Joseph's, and during the summer holiday, Aunt Mary and Uncle Tom rented a vacation cottage for the whole family in Pass Christian, a Gulfside resort in Mississippi. Here, they could pretend to be the respectable family that Josie yearned for. But when the Bradys traveled up to Emmitsburg to take Anna for her second year at the academy, they encountered trouble. They telephoned the school from their hotel and spoke to the Mother Superior, who coldly informed them that Anna was no longer welcome at the school. "Do not come," the nun said, "or you will hear more than you want to hear." Apparently, the father of another pupil from New Orleans had told the Mother Superior about Mrs. Brady's true identity. Now, Anna was being unceremoniously expelled. What Josie told her remarkably naive niece is not known, but evidently she found some way of explaining the necessity of returning immediately to New Orleans. And once there, her aunt went to work finding an alternative plan that would ensure that Anna remained comfortably ignorant of the source of her upkeep. The solution Josie ultimately found was extreme. If Maryland was not distant enough to keep Anna free of the taint of Storyville, maybe a different continent would be. And so, Josie Arlington, a.k.a. Mary Brady, made arrangements for a surrogate to run the brothel for a few months. She and her husband were going to take Anna Dubler to Europe. Chapter 9. Jazz Men. The years immediately following the Robert Charles riot were not easy ones for Black New Orleans. Bitterness over the 4 days of rampant violence did not pass quickly, and the twin insults of disenfranchisement and increasing segregation only grew more intolerable as the months passed. But despite the worsening situation, or perhaps partly because of it, the new music of the ghetto seemed to be thriving. By 1903, in fact, the raggedy sound was making inroads all over the city, often in some surprising venues. "The Knights of Pleasure Club requests the presence of your company at their first grand soiree at the Ladies' Providence Hall, corner of Philip and Liberty Streets, Wednesday evening, February 18th, 03. Music by Professor Bolden's Orchestra. Dancing from 8 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. Subscription 15 cents. This advertisement, the only written notice of a Buddy Bolden performance surviving in the historical record, would seem to promise a somewhat staid and genteel event. After all, a grand soiree at something called the Ladies' Providence Hall, with music by one Professor Bolden, sounds like an eminently respectable gathering. And perhaps it was. Bolden's mother, Alice, was a member of the Ladies' Providence Society, and the city's instrumental ensembles were by necessity flexible, playing music appropriate to whatever audience had hired them. But given that a Bolden performance the very next month was raided by police, this advertisement may be unrepresentative. A more typical Bolden venue was the Oddfellows Hall on Perdido Street near Black Storyville, where a Labor Day ball that same year was promoted in a very different way. "Tell all your friends," Bolden allegedly told a crowd some days before the event. "If you likes raggedy music, come one, come all. You all can dance any kind of way. And don't forget, there's a prize for the bitch who'll shake it hardest. And I don't mean her snoot." So life was hardly all doom and gloom in the Black neighborhoods of New Orleans, and the new music both reflected and contributed to that fact. Audiences were clamoring for it, and musicians like Bolden were fast becoming celebrities. The main topic of talk with the people around town was music, like, who was a famous trumpet player? One New Orleanian remembered. They spoke of these great musicians. They were idolized. Any event would become an excuse to hear jazz, and often the music itself was the excuse to hold an event. All over New Orleans on Saturday night, there'd be fish fries, according to bassist Pops Foster. To advertise, you'd get a carriage with the horses all dressed up, a bunch of pretty girls, and then the musicians would get on, and you'd go all over, advertising for that night. The fish fry that had the best band was the one that would have the best crowd. Out on the shores of nearby Lake Pontchartrain were three resorts, Spanish Fort, West End, and Milnburg, that were popular destinations for weekend outings. Each camp or pavilion would have its own band playing, all within earshot of the others, allowing for some fruitful cross-pollination of styles. The picnics at the lake were the ideal place for the younger people to hear the different bands and musicians, guitarist Johnny St. Cyr explained. We could hear them all at different camps and picnic grounds, and, needless to say, we all had our favorites. Storyville, too, soon became an important venue for the new music. At first, the establishments of the district were reluctant to hire bands. If customers were busy dancing, after all, they couldn't be buying drinks or women. But eventually, the music proved too popular to ignore. Bolden's band and other hot ensembles were soon playing regularly at Storyville clubs like Nancy Hank's Saloon and Big 25. Tom Anderson's Annex began by hiring a string trio with piano, guitar, and violin, but eventually became a place for larger bands as well. Even the brothels wanted the new music, usually in the form of a single piano professor playing in the parlor while clients chose their partners for the night. According to some reports, Countess Willie Piazza was the first madam to bring music into her house, hiring a legendary pianist known as John the Baptist to play on her famous white grand. Pianists such as Tony Jackson, Clarence Williams, and Jelly Roll Morton eventually found their own regular gigs in the district at Lulu White's, Gypsy Schaefer's, Hilma Burt's, and the other Basin Street brothels. And while Storyville can in no way be considered the birthplace of jazz, as has sometimes been claimed, the various district venues did provide many early jazzmen with vital employment and helped to bring their music to a wider and often non-black audience. Two of the most important settings for the development of early jazz opened in 1902. Lincoln and Johnson Parks, located right across the street from each other just off South Carrollton Avenue, quickly became popular gathering places for the city's black population. They were much closer to the central city than the lake resorts, and therefore were more accessible locales for picnics, prize fights, and other entertainments throughout the week. Lincoln Park, the larger and more developed of the two, hosted a skating rink, a theater, and a performance barn where large dances and sporting events could be held. Lincoln was also the site of one of Black New Orleans' most storied events, the weekly hot air balloon ascensions of Buddy Bartley, the park's manager, who was also known to New Orleans police as a pimp and small-time criminal. The heavily advertised ascensions would feature the aerialist Bartley going up in the balloon, to a full orchestral accompaniment, of course, and flying around for a time before dramatically jumping from the basket and parachuting to the ground. How the balloon itself was brought to earth after its pilot had decamped is unclear. One hard-to-credit story holds that it was actually brought down with a rifle shot, but the spectacle was one of the most memorable entertainments of the era for many New Orleanians. Bartley's regular ascensions, in fact, came to an end only after a mishap left him seriously injured. According to a witness, one Sunday he drifted too far because of the high winds, and when it was time for his parachute jump back to earth from the balloon, instead of landing in the park as usual, he wound up in the chimney of one of the houses fairly close to Lincoln Park. And what a mess he was. The attractions offered at Johnson Park across the street were usually less elaborate. The place was principally a baseball park, though it was also used for picnics and open-air concerts, and typically attracted a somewhat rougher crowd than its neighbor. It was in Johnson Park that Buddy Bolden normally played, often to the chagrin of those playing in the neighboring Lincoln Park. The regular band at Lincoln was the Excelsior, led by John Robichaud, a well-regarded Creole entrepreneur who had dominated the black music scene in the 1890s. On more than a few Sundays, Robichaud's band would be packing them in at the Lincoln Performance Barn when Bolden and his crew were preparing to play at Johnson. But Bolden wouldn't be worried, because he had a secret weapon, his cornet. According to his friend, Louis Jones, that's where Buddy used to say to trombonist Willie Cornish and them, say, "Cornish, come on. Put your hands through the window. Put your trombone out there. I'm going to call my children home." Buddy would start to play, and all the people out of Lincoln Park would come on over where Buddy was. The crowds came not just because Bolden played loud, though he did do that, but because he played hot and down low. Robichaud and his band of highly polished, academically trained musicians played sweet, that is, the straighter, more traditional and refined music, beloved of the city's educated Creoles of color. But, as one musician put it, Old King Bolden played the music the Negro public liked. It was bluesier, more spontaneous, and at times downright raunchy. One crowd pleaser that soon became Bolden's signature number was Funky Butt, a.k.a. Buddy Bolden's Blues, a barrelhouse blues with ever-changing lyrics that could range from the light and comic to the low and coarse. I thought I heard Buddy Bolden say, funky butt, take it away. You're nasty, you're dirty, take it away. I thought I heard Buddy Bolden shout, open up that window and let the bad air out. To Creoles like Robichaud and the other Dicty people, as they were called, this kind of vulgarity was distasteful. As one musician put it, when the settled Creole folks first heard this jazz, they passed the opinion that it sounded like the rough Negro element. But in the racially polarizing atmosphere of turn-of-the-century New Orleans, they often couldn't avoid it. A lot of the skilled trades traditionally pursued by Creoles were now being closed off to them in the new world of Jim Crow. Many were forced to turn to music as a profession rather than just a hobby, which meant playing the newer style of music pioneered by Bolden and the other early jazz men. Even an establishment figure like Robichaud soon found defectors in his own ranks. George Baquet, a Creole clarinetist who played sweet with Robichaud for many years, found himself attracted to the new style and would sometimes sit in with Bolden on an occasional gig. One evening, the Bolden and Robichaud bands were playing in two rival saloons not far from each other. The two groups decided to have one of the cutting contests so beloved among black audiences of the day, the winner to be determined by the response of the audience. At first, Bolden's band seemed to dominate, but then Baquet came to the rescue of the Robichaud group. He played a wild stunt routine in which he would gradually throw away various parts of his clarinet while continuing to play as if it were still whole. By the end, he was playing the mouthpiece alone, to the roaring approval of the crowd, who granted the win to Robichaud hands down. What the Creole maestro himself thought of the performance is unknown. It was just the kind of low gimmick he likely would have disapproved of, but the rare win against Bolden must have been at least somewhat gratifying. As for Buddy himself, he was reportedly furious. "George, why did you do it?" he hissed to Baquet afterward, apparently stung by being defeated at his own game. Bolden's music was particularly influential among younger downtown Creoles, who were less likely than their elders to cling to their sense of separateness from the uptown African Americans. Jim Crow was forcibly pushing the two groups together, and it was the young who adapted most readily to the change, both socially and musically. "Bolden caused all that," one Creole musician admitted. "He caused these younger Creoles to have a different style from the old heads." But the young Creole musicians who began to play hot brought with them the greater reading skills and more polished technique of downtown, changing the new style even as it was changing them. Bolden's influence, in fact, was soon being felt well beyond the borders of New Orleans. The Bolden Band and other groups often traveled out into the hinterlands, playing at harvest festivals, payday parties, parish fairs, and other events, and they spread the gospel of jazz wherever they went. "I came to New Orleans in 1906, when I was 14 years old," pianist Clarence Williams explained. "It was after I heard Buddy Bolden, when he came through my hometown, Plaquemine, Louisiana, on an excursion, and his trumpet playing excited me so that I said, 'I'm going to New Orleans.' I had never heard anything like that before in my life." A man who was to become one of the most important figures in the second generation of New Orleans jazzmen, Edward Kid Ory, had a similar story to tell. Growing up in the sugar mill town of La Place, some 25 miles upriver from New Orleans, young Ory would hear bands like Bolden's, Edward Clem's, and Charlie Galloway's playing a banquet or other event and be intrigued. "Sometimes," he later wrote, "the guys would put the horns down and be drinking beer. I'd slip in and get one of the horns and try to blow it. I noticed how they were putting it into their mouths, and I'd just keep on till I got a tone. We were all self-taught." The son of a white father of Alsatian ancestry and a mixed-race mother, Ori had the straight hair, light skin, and Anglo features to pass for white. But since he was black by law, he had to contend with the diminished job expectations allowed to members of that race. Becoming a musician seemed to be an excellent route out of the drudgery of a life of sugar production. So, Ori soon formed a band with a few like-minded friends. At first, since none of them could afford instruments, they styled themselves as a humming group, harmonizing tunes on a nearby bridge at night. "It was dark, so no one could see us," Ori recalled, "but people could hear us singing, and they'd bring us a few ginger cakes and some water. We hummed, and when we knowed the tune itself, the melody, the others would put a 3 or 4 part harmony to it. It was good ear training." Eventually, Ori's group made their own musical instruments, constructing a 5-string dinner pail banjo, a cigar box guitar, and a soapbox bass. "After finishing the 3 instruments, we started practicing in the daytime, but evenings would find us drifting to our favorite spot, the bridge, and the people, especially the youngsters, found us there and would hang around listening to us play, and they would start dancing there in the dusty road. It made us feel wonderful." In 1900, when Ori was just 13, his mother died, followed less than a year later by his father. The boy had to move in with his older sister's family on the sugar plantation. But he was already making plans to leave, pinning his hopes on a fine new banjo his father had bought for him 2 weeks before his death. Ori worked a series of hard labor jobs for the next few years, first at a lumber yard and then for a bricklaying crew, where his drunken, abusive overseer would sometimes rouse the boy from sleep to play him some blues on the banjo. All along, though, he was honing his musical skills, branching out from the banjo to the instrument that would later make him famous, the trombone. When he was about 16 or 17, he bought himself an old beat-up valve trombone for $7.50 and started practicing with it. The instrument was so riddled with holes that he had to stuff them with soap to get a decent tone. This worked all right at first, but after playing for a while, he'd find himself blowing bubbles. Finally, he borrowed $100 to buy real instruments for the rest of his band. "Then we had some real rehearsing with the honest-to-God instruments," Ori wrote, "and decided we were good enough to play at the local ball games." The ultimate goal, of course, was to move to New Orleans and make a living there, but Ori had promised his mother before she died that he wouldn't leave La Place until he was 21. In the meantime, though, he and his friends took weekend trips into the city to hear the bands they emulated. On one such trip in 1905, Ori went to Werlein's Music Store on Canal Street and bought a new trombone. Later, as he was trying out the new instrument at his older sister's house on South Robertson Street, a passerby heard him and knocked on the door. "Young man, are you blowing the trombone?" the man asked. Ori told him he was. "Well," the man continued, "you know who I am?" Ori didn't. The man said, "I'm the king." It was King Bolden himself, and he was apparently quite impressed by Ori's playing. "I'd like to have you work for me," Bolden said. "You sound very good." Ori was thrilled, but since he was still only 18 years old, his sister put an end to all such talk. "Oh, no, he has to go back home to La Place," she insisted. "He can't leave home now till he's 21 years old." But Ori did keep in touch with Bolden. Whenever the young trombonist and his friends came to town, they'd seek out the members of the Bolden Band wherever they were playing, at Johnson Park, Odd Fellows Hall, or the Dance Hall on Perdido Street, also used as a Baptist church, where Bolden played so often that it was soon better known as Funky Butt Hall. And although Ori did admire many of the other bands in town, including that of Robichaux, from whom Ori learned the more polished manner of playing that was later to characterize his own mature style, Bolden was his first and arguably his most influential favorite. So many of the young players around New Orleans at this time cited their first taste of Bolden's music as a seminal experience. Sidney Bechet, who would become perhaps the greatest jazz clarinetist of all time, first heard Bolden playing on the street when he was 7 or 8. He was never the same afterward. As the youngest child of a traditional Creole family, he had often been taken by his mother to the French Opera House on Bourbon Street to hear some of the great soloists of the day. Enrico Caruso was an early favorite. But Sidney seemed more inspired by the syncopated music he heard on the streets of New Orleans. When he was barely six, his mother found him trying to blow the nozzle of her douche like a horn. Mortified but amused, she responded by giving the boy a small fife to play with. He practiced on it for hours at a time and soon mastered it. Then he started playing his brother Leonard's clarinet on the sly. One day his mother heard him secretly practicing under the porch. She was about to scold him for fooling with his brother's possessions, but then she heard what the boy could do with the instrument. She immediately arranged to get him his own clarinet and sign him up for formal lessons. Sidney proved to be a disobedient student. A series of old-school Creole teachers wanted him to practice scales and classical marches, but the boy had his own ideas. Then came the day he heard Bolden. It was during a street parade when Bolden and his band got into a cutting contest with the more traditional Imperial band. Sidney was mesmerized, at least until a stick-wielding cop came along and spoiled the fun. "It was down there around Canal Street somewheres," Bechet would later recall. "I was awful little then, and a policeman come along, and he looked at my head, and he looked at my ass, and he smacked me good with that stick he was carrying. I ran home then, and I was really hurting some. I couldn't even sit down for dinner that night, and my mother, she took one look at me, and she knew right away where I'd been." His parents and teachers, and even his older brother Leonard, didn't approve of Bolden's brand of ratty music. "Us Creole musicians always did hold up a nice prestige," Leonard Bechet insisted. "But that's the kind of music Sidney wanted to play. All of those interpreting moans and groans and happy sounds," as he later put it. And his musical taste sometimes got him into trouble. "No, no, no," his teacher, Luis Papatillo, would tell him. "We do not bark like a dog or meow like a cat." The admonition fell on deaf ears. Bechet began to model his clarinet playing on the rough uptown style of Big Eye Louie Nelson, from whom he even took a few lessons. These were much more to his taste. "Some musicians played the tune prettily," he later said, "but I like the playing that makes me want to dance." At his brother's 21st birthday party in April 1907, 10-year-old Sidney had a chance to show off what he'd learned. His mother had booked the band of cornetist Manuel Perez to play for the party. But at the last minute, Perez had sent a replacement band, led by the young Creole cornet player Freddie Keppard, whose style of music may have been a bit earthy for the proper Mrs. Bechet. Keppard's clarinetist, the ubiquitous George Bechet, was late for the gig, so the band started playing without him. Sidney saw his chance. "I knew I was too young for them," he later recalled, "but I sure wanted to play along with them all the same." So he began improvising a quiet clarinet accompaniment to Keppard's lead. But he did it from another room, not wanting to risk being publicly reprimanded by the older musicians. As the story goes, Keppard heard Sidney's clarinet and thought it was Bechet warming up in the other room. But then Bechet himself showed up, and the identity of the phantom clarinetist was revealed. Bechet was impressed, and, despite taking some hearty ribbing from the other band members, he sat little Sidney down right next to him. "He kept me there all evening, playing right along beside him," Bechet remembered. "That night, I guess I was the richest kid in New Orleans. You couldn't have bought me for a sky full of new moons." To hear his contemporaries tell it, Bechet was, in a city full of great musicians, a phenomenon, a natural, who could play virtually any instrument he touched. "I used to see Sidney around violinist Armand Pyron's barbershop," one musician recalled. "Now, Pyron had a house full of every kind of instrument, so this little boy, he come in one day and pick up the flute. 'What is that?' he asked Pyron. 'That is a flute, Sidney,' Pyron tell him. So Sidney start right in playing it. 'Show Pyron what is a flute. Put that down. Walk over and pick up a saxophone and say, "What is that?" 'That's a new something they call a saxophone, son.' 'Well, it looked like a pipe to me. I see if this pipe will make a tune.' And be damned if he didn't start making the thing just talk." The boy soon became so accomplished that Bechet himself would sometimes employ him as a substitute. According to Sidney's brother Leonard, "When Bechet wanted to lay off, he used to come and speak to my mother and ask could he take Sidney to play in his place for the evening. Mrs. Bechet, the old-school Creole lady, was reluctant. "We didn't want to jeopardize our family by mixing with the rough element," Leonard explained. "We worried a lot about Sidney when he'd be out playing. So, when Bechet would come for Sidney, Mother would insist that he be sure to bring the boy back and not lose him. Bechet would promise, and he'd generally bring him back about 2 in the morning. Sidney would bring money home to Mother and tell her, 'Don't worry, he was all right.'" Mrs. Bechet may not have been happy about her son playing in saloons and dance halls, but it was the type of compromise that Creoles of color increasingly were forced to make in 1900s New Orleans. Any difference between Creoles, often educated, urban, and middle class, and African Americans, the children of slaves more recently arrived from the countryside, was gone now, at least in the eyes of whites. Negro and disreputable had become functionally synonymous, and many younger Creoles in response began rejecting their parents' now outdated scruples. In any case, Mrs. Bechet's strong-willed and irrepressible son had made his choice of lifestyle, and there was little she could have done to keep him respectable, even if she had tried. But not every young Creole musician was pulled into the orbit of Bolden and the other uptown jazzmen. Jelly Roll Morton, nay Ferdinand Joseph Lamanth, on October 20, 1890, was a Creole pianist who affected a casual disdain for the music of what he called uptown Negroes. A musician of stunning originality himself, he was busily developing his own unique blend of piano-based ragtime, dance music, and blues, a Spanish-tinged style that would eventually have its own claim as the prototype for the kind of music still a decade away from being known as jazz. Like many Creoles of the era, Morton, who changed his name from Lamanth because he didn't want to be called Frenchy, grew up in an atmosphere saturated with music. His godmother paid for guitar lessons for the boy when he was very young. By the time he was 7, he was already an accomplished musician, playing in a 3-piece string band that performed late-night serenades for their neighbors in the 7th Ward. One day at a party, he heard a man playing a very good piece of ragtime on the piano and decided that this was the instrument for him. He began studying with a series of teachers, some better than others, and was soon proficient enough to have something of a reputation around town. One Saturday night, he and his friends were on a wild jaunt through the Tenderloin when they were approached by someone looking for a pianist to fill in at one of the district's houses of ill fame. Young Morton, he was about 15 at the time, agreed to go along, but insisted that his friends come too for moral support. As he later told the story, "I was so frightened when I first touched the piano that the girls decided to let me go immediately. One of my friends spoke up, 'Go ahead and show these people you can play.' That encouraged me greatly, and I pulled myself together and started playing with the confidence of being in my own circle. 'That boy is marvelous,' this was the remarks of the inmates. Money was plentiful, and they tipped me about $20. At the end of the night, Morton was offered a job as the brothel's regular professor. He hesitated at first, worried what his proper Creole family might think. But eventually he took the position and merely told his family that he had switched to the night shift at his regular job at a barrel-making factory. He soon became a denizen of the district, and one of its most evocative chroniclers. "The streets were crowded with men," he would later recall. "Lights of all colors were glittering and glaring. Music was pouring into the streets from every house. Women were standing in the doorways, singing or chanting some kind of blues, some very happy, some very sad, some with the desire to end it all by poison, some planning a big outing, a dance, or some other kind of enjoyment. Some were real ladies, in spite of their downfall, and some were habitual drunkards, and some were dope fiends." The young Creole professor became a favorite among the brothel women, who often wheedled big tips for him from their customers. Soon Morton had more money than I ever heard of in my life. He eventually had a diamond implanted in one of his front teeth and bought a loud new suit with a Stetson hat and a pair of St. Louis flats shoes with toes that turned up almost to his ankles. He was wearing those clothes when he ran into his great-grandmother on the street one Sunday morning. She was just returning from church, and it was quite obvious to her that the same was not true of her great-grandson. It was to be a life-changing encounter for Morton. When she heard about it, his grandmother, whom he had been living with since his mother's death the year before, kicked him out of the house. At the age of 16, he was now on his own, and although his Creole pride would keep him somewhat aloof from the mainstream of the uptown African-American music scene, unlike Bashe, Keppard, and some of the other young Creoles, he soon became an important force in the development of New Orleans jazz, though, as Louis Armstrong would later remark, no matter how much his diamond sparkled, he still had to eat in the kitchen, the same as we blacks. Creoles weren't the only players succumbing to the attraction of the new sound. By 1905 or so, the music had become popular enough in saloons and dance halls to start making an impression on the city's young, working-class white musicians. Some of the best bands in New Orleans during this era were those of Papa Jack Lane, a white band leader and entrepreneur who often had several groups playing around town at once. Lane's Reliance bands generally played sweet, reading from music with little of the improvisation or bending of notes so characteristic of the uptown black bands. But Lane had a few musicians in his fold who took an avid interest in the hotter style. Cornetist Nick LaRocca, trombonist Tom Brown, clarinetist Larry Shields, and several others who played with Lane's groups were soon blowing their own version of the new sound. And although LaRocca in particular would deny the influence, in fact, he, like Jelly Roll Morton, would later claim to have invented jazz himself, reports of white musicians listening in on performances of the black bands are too numerous to be ignored. Like many of the early white jazzmen, LaRocca was Sicilian, as was, for that matter, Jack Lane, whose real name was Vitale. As such, he was already considered ipso facto disreputable by the likes of the Garden District elite. Playing jazz just reinforced that impression. Whites who played jazz altered their racial identity, as one historian has put it, becoming less white in the eyes of respectable Caucasians. And LaRocca, again like many of the Creoles, had to face the disapproval of his family when his interest in music went beyond the acceptable weekend hobby stage, when Girolamo LaRocca discovered that his young son Nick had taught himself to play his, Girolamo's, own cornet. The father took the instrument out to the yard and destroyed it with an axe. Fortunately, this didn't discourage the boy for long, and he soon had saved up enough money to buy his own cornet. But when his father found out about it, he grabbed his axe and smashed the new cornet as well. Despite such discouragements, the new music was soon attracting white audiences as well, and not only among the working classes. Edmund Souchon, a doctor who grew up in New Orleans in what he called the citadel of white caste privileges, described stealing off to the district when he was still a boy in short pants in order to hear his idol, Joe Oliver, playing at Big 25. When challenged by police, Souchon would claim to be a newsboy delivering a paper that Oliver had ordered from him, which worked for a time. Bassist Pops Foster remembered lots of whites listening to jazz in the early years, even in allegedly all-black venues. Most saloons had two sides, one for whites and one for colored. The colored had so much fun on their side, dancing, singing, and guitar playing, that you couldn't get in for the whites. It was the same way at Lincoln Park for the colored. You couldn't tell who it was for. There were so many whites there. Still, given its association with sex, alcohol, a rise in cocaine use among blacks, and interracial mixing, the music was developing a major image problem in the early years of the 20th century. The entire culture of jazz seemed an affront to decency for many people in New Orleans, including many middle-class blacks. Describing the scene at a Negro dance hall in 1902, the item could barely contain its abhorrence. The orchestra consisted of a clarinet, a guitar, and a bass fiddle. The guitar was plucked by a bullet-headed Negro with a faraway look in his eyes, and a molasses-colored musician that blew the clarinet had to brace his feet against the railing of the player's stand to prevent himself from being hurled backward by the strength of his breath, which at each blast into the instrument had the effect of making the player kick back like a shotgun. Even the music had an indecent ring about it that was disgusting. The bad image of jazz and jazzmen was also not helped by the growing number of violent incidents occurring in places where the music was played. Jelly Roll Morton described one incident at a Bolden performance, probably in early 1905, at Jackson Hall. A short, ill-tempered man was standing at the bar listening to the music when a great big husky guy stepped on his foot. An argument erupted between the two, with Morton standing right between them, during which the small man pulled out a very large gun and shot the other man at close range, just barely missing the pianist. "This big guy laid there on the floor dead," Morton recalled, "and my goodness, Buddy Bolden, he was up on the balcony with the band, started blazing away with his trumpet, trying to keep the crowd together. Many of us realized it was a killing, and we started breaking out windows and through doors and just run over the police they had there." Bolden himself was arrested in the incident, much to Morton's puzzlement. "I've often wondered why they would put Mr. Bolden in the patrol wagon when he was up there blowing high notes to keep everyone quiet." But King Bolden in particular seemed to be regarded by the white establishment, when they became aware of him, as a threat. Sidney Bechet recalled the reaction when his own band would play Funky Butt. "When we started off playing Buddy's theme song, I thought I heard Buddy Bolden say, 'The police put you in jail if they heard you singing that song.'" Like the Robert Charles song, Buddy Bolden's song had political connotations that the police tried hard to discourage. As one historian has noted, both were manifestations of cultural resistance within African American circles. Each made the white power structure nervous. Even the way these black men dressed was considered a provocation. "These guys wouldn't wear anything but a blue coat and some kind of stripe in their trousers," Jelly Roll Morton recalled. "And those trousers had to be very, very tight. They'd fit 'em like a sausage. I'm telling you, it was very seldom you could button the top button of a person's trousers those days in New Orleans." One of Bolden's suspenders would always be hanging down, and his shirt would be busted open so that you could discern his red flannel undershirt. And all of this was carried off with a kind of strut or mosey walk, commonly known as walking the agate, that allegedly made the women wild. But Bolden's days as leader of this defiant subculture were to be tragically brief. The year 1905 marked the peak of his popularity. At that point, as one witness put it, just the sight of the famous cornetist was enough to satisfy some of his fans. Whenever he practiced on his front steps, neighborhood children would gather around him on the sidewalks, shouting, "King Bolden, King Bolden." And his effect on women was legendary. In 1902, he had met and married one of his neighbors, Nora Bass, a 22-year-old mixed-race woman from a religious family, and had had a daughter by her sometime the next year. But the attention he received from his young female fans didn't end. Sometimes, according to one of his friends, he would have to run away from the women. But this kind of celebrity eventually took its toll. In March of 1906, Bolden began to experience severe headaches. Other symptoms appeared. He seemed disoriented at times, failed to recognize his friends, and would walk the streets talking incoherently to strangers. Sometimes his mother and sister would have to send Buddy's friend, Louis Jones, to find him and bring him home. He even developed what seemed to be a fear of his own cornet. No one really knows what caused Bolden to begin losing his grip on reality. Some said he drank too much and slept too little. Others said he simply succumbed to the pressure of having to keep innovating to avoid becoming yesterday's sensation. Louis Jones thought it might have something to do with an untreated ear infection. But the mother of drummer Paul Barbarin had the simplest explanation. She'd always told her son that Bolden would blow his brains out someday because he just played too loud. Whatever the cause, his deterioration was rapid. He eventually was even kicked out of his own band. After Buddy had failed to pay his band members once too often, they began arranging their own gigs without him. At the start of one of these engagements, at Oddfellows Hall on Perdido, Bolden arrived late, only to find that his band had replaced him with his old rival, Edward Clem. "You can go back home," Frankie Dewson, his second cornetist, told him.
"You mean to tell me you're going to put me out of my own band?" Bolden asked.
He reminded Dewson that he had hired the younger man,
"when nobody would have you."
"That makes no difference," Dewson replied. "I'm the king now."
In the spring of 1906, while bedridden and being tended by his mother and his mother-in-law, Ida Bass, Bolden turned violent.
Convinced that he was being poisoned, he jumped out of bed and attacked Mrs. Bass with a water pitcher. She suffered only a minor head wound, and Bolden was soon calmed down again. But the two women, concerned that more violence might follow, had him arrested on a charge of insanity. He was held in jail for a few days and released, but there were more incidents and arrests to come. According to one uncorroborated story, Bolden even threw a neighbor's baby out of a window. Soon, parents and older siblings were warning kids away from him. "He's nuts, you know," one neighbor explained to his younger brother. Bolden's last gig was playing for the Labor Day Parade in New Orleans later that year. It was a huge parade, and virtually every musician in town would have been playing in it. But sometime before the marching was over, Bolden had to drop out. He spent a troubled week at home, and by Saturday, his mental state was bad enough for his mother to have him incarcerated again on an insanity charge. Again, he was released after a few days, but he was by now too far gone for help. He spent the winter drinking heavily and doing little else. Then, on March 13, 1907, Alice Bolden had her son arrested for a third and final time. Bolden sat in the house of detention for several weeks before finally being transferred to the state insane asylum in Jackson, Louisiana. The commitment document read in part as follows: Character of disease, insanity. Cause of insanity, alcohol. Is patient dangerous to himself or others? To others. Bolden would remain at Jackson for the rest of his life. But though the first king of jazz was gone, there were many musicians in New Orleans who would carry on and expand upon his legacy. One of them was just a small boy when Bolden was put away. He would later tell conflicting stories about whether he really remembered hearing Bolden play, but it was actually likely that he did. He lived quite near Funky Butt Hall on Perdido, and recalled listening, when he was a boy of 4 or 5, just when Bolden would have been at his peak, to a band playing to advertise Saturday night dances in the hall. "Before the dance," the boy would later write, "the band would play out front about a half hour, and us little kids would all do little dances. If I ever heard Buddy Bolden play the cornet, I figure that's when." The boy was named Louis Armstrong, and he would eventually do more than anyone in history to spread Bolden's new sound beyond the confines of the ghettos of New Orleans and out into the world. Chapter 10. The Sin Factory. Are we to have a wide open city? Representative Anderson of the 4th Ward of the city, but commonly known as the mayor of Storyville, has succeeded in passing through the House of Representatives a bill allowing prize fights up to 25 rounds in regularly organized clubs in New Orleans without asking the consent of the mayor. Doubtless the classes whom Mr. Anderson specially represents desire a wide open city, and so far there has been nothing to prevent it. It will be astonishing if the General Assembly of Louisiana shall permit the purveyors of vice and the habitués of the purlieus of New Orleans to set the legal and official standard of the morals of the city. New Orleans Daily Picayune, June 20, 1902. By 1905, the city of New Orleans, or at least that part of it known to an increasing portion of the world as Storyville, was just about as wide open as the poor Daily Picayune had feared. In the 7 or 8 years since the district had been open, it had developed into a vast, well-functioning factory of sin, as lucrative and efficient as any lumber mill or city gasworks in the country. Its 230 brothels, 60 assignation houses, and scores of one-room cribs could by now process the raw materials of male sexual desire at an astonishing rate of speed. "I'll tell you, 5 minutes was a long time to spend in one of those rooms," one customer said of a typical brothel visit. "In fact, from the time you'd come in the front door of the house until you'd be back on the banquet sidewalk, hardly ever took more than 15 minutes. And there you'd be, standing on the banquet without a cent in your pocket and no place to go but maybe home. And that would be the last place in the world you'd want to go." Like the factories of other American industries, moreover, the vice mills of Storyville were kept churning day and night, rotating workers as needed. This Tenderloin district was like something that nobody has ever seen before or since, Jelly Roll Morton insisted. The doors were taken off the saloons from one year to the next. Why bother with doors, after all, if your establishment never closed? Even the crib women marched to and from their shifts like factory workers. A lot of the prostitutes lived in different sections of the city and would come down to Storyville just like they had a job. Louis Armstrong remembered. There were different shifts for them. Sometimes two prostitutes would share the rent in the same crib together. One would work in the day, and the other would beat out that night shift. The high-toned houses of Basin Street, despite their pretensions, were likewise operated with an eye to a maximally efficient revenue stream, and the smaller brothels could be virtual assembly lines of sex. Those places were organized to take all your money, one customer explained. Let's say you went into a so-called $2 house. Well, you couldn't very well sit down in the parlor without buying a little wine, or at least putting some change in the player piano. It would cost you usually a couple of dollars before you even got around to the business you came for. Clever girls, once they got you in a boudoir, would always offer little extra services, for extra prices, naturally, and you'd pay. Things are not easy to resist at such times. And lest the laborers of the district waste their time trying to exploit an already spent resource, customers were typically sent on their way with a lanyap, a little bonus, like a rose for their buttonhole or a feather for their hat, so that the hustlers in the bars and nightclubs would know you'd already had it for the night. If Storyville was indeed an industry, then its chief industrialist, the Andrew Carnegie of the Carnal, was none other than Thomas C. Anderson. According to at least some reports, there was no transaction that occurred in the district of which he did not get a cut. Anderson was, according to Jelly Roll Morton, the king of the district. And like a king, he took tribute from all of his subjects. When Lulu White, for instance, had a free-spending group of celebrants in her house, she would send someone down Basin Street to the annex for a quick delivery of the really good champagne. White would charge her customers $5 per bottle, a hefty sum in 1905 currency, but Anderson would get no less than $4 of that. It was easy money for very little effort, but Anderson was the man with connections to the liquor distributors, and so it was paid. Given his political connections, his commercial dominance, and his considerable personal magnetism, he was now arguably one of the most powerful men in New Orleans, dispensing advice, protection, charity, and patronage wherever they were needed. And to those who dwelled in his 18-square-block realm, now called Anderson County by newspaper wags, his word was law. From time to time, one Storyville memoirist explained, the highly honored and respected Tom Anderson would send forth an order, close all the houses till the heat's off, or no gambling, the police is going to raid all the joints. Compliance was instant. Doors would be locked and all lights put out. The joints would be abandoned and deserted until Anderson sent word that the heat was off and they could resume business. Soon his establishment on the corner of Basin and Iberville, the new name for Custom House Street after 1904, was becoming nationally, if not world, famous. When a writer for Collier's Magazine visited New Orleans, he wrote about the reigning vice lord with barely concealed incredulity. Tom Anderson overtops the restricted district. He is its lawgiver and its king. In his shadow flourish the unblushing street-open shame of Iberville and Conti and St. Louis streets, the saloons with their wide-open poker and crap games, the dives where Negroes buy for 50 cents, 5 cents worth of cocaine. He is, too, the buffer between the poor, foolish, awkward law written in the books and the people who dwell under his kindlier law. For example, when a woman of Anderson County commits robbery, and when the victim complains so loudly that she has to be arrested, Tom Anderson comes down and gets her out. He does not even have to give cash bail. But the bad publicity, that eternal oxymoron, merely brought more and more people to the district. Many of them were celebrities. When the actress Sarah Bernhardt visited New Orleans, she took the obligatory tour of the Storyville district. She showed particular interest in a street-corner performance by Emile Stalebread LeCoum and his Razzy-Dazzy Spasm Band of youngsters playing on homemade instruments. though her tip to the band was, according to one witness, below whore scale. At the Annex, Anderson would play host to some of the greatest sports figures of the era, including boxer Gentleman Jim Corbett and baseball legends Babe Ruth, Frank Chance, and Ty Cobb. When George M. Cohen showed up at the bar one night, he amused everyone by performing tricks with his derby hat, rolling it up and down his arms in time to the music of the resident jazz combo. And Anderson was nothing if not a considerate host. When boxer John L. Sullivan, late in his career, came to town for an exhibition bout and got too drunk to walk straight, it was the mayor of Storyville who escorted the aging warrior home from the Annex to his boarding house on Rampart Street. But this was the way of Tom Anderson, who, as despots go, tended toward the benevolent. According to those who knew him, he was always immaculate, cool-headed, and calm, no matter what the situation. He was especially polite to women, even those who were drunk. He listened to their love problems, when their men were there and when these women came in alone, one friend said, and Tom's advice was always palliative and reasonable. Take it easy, he'd say. Everything will turn out for the better. Don't do nothing drastic. You may regret it. No wonder, then, that he was such a popular figure, not only among the denizens of the Tenderloin, but also in the halls of the state legislature in Baton Rouge. Anderson had an easy amiability and wry sense of humor that could disarm even his most rabid political enemies. When making a long argument against a proposed coal bill in 1904, his speech, even in the opinion of the usually hostile Picayune, was characteristically humorous and provided much merriment in the chamber. It also succeeded in getting the measure quashed. For although the papers would rarely admit it, Tom Anderson was actually a fairly effective representative and one who espoused some unquestionably noble causes. He was a member of the Ways and Means Committee and took a special interest in improving the atrocious conditions at many state institutions, especially the Louisiana State Insane Asylum at Jackson, where Buddy Bolden was incarcerated, although there's no evidence that the two actually ever met. In 1905, when Louisiana faced one of its periodic epidemics of yellow fever, Anderson, as proprietor of the Record Oil Company, generously donated a large supply of oil to the city. Oil was used to kill mosquito larvae that bred in the city's ubiquitous water cisterns. And later that year, when President Theodore Roosevelt came to New Orleans as a gesture of solidarity with the fever-stricken city, the Democratic mayor of Storyville was named to the honorary committee that welcomed the staunchly Republican president. A picture of the two of them shaking hands would adorn a wall behind the Annex Bar for many years to come. Not that some of his pet causes couldn't be viewed as somewhat self-serving. When Representative Anderson sponsored bills to raise the salaries of New Orleans police and court stenographers, he was surely implementing the lesson he had learned early in his career, namely that favors produced friends and that friends, in turn, produced favors. Naturally, it didn't always work. The New Orleans Police Department in this era was still too fractured by rivalries and competing factions for any politician to be friends with everyone on the force. And although Anderson was chummy enough with Chief John Journey to invite him to his daughter's wedding, he still faced occasional police harassment. Even then, however, Anderson had ways of appeasing his antagonists. When, during one of the police department's occasional grandstanding efforts to enforce the widely ignored Sunday closing law, Anderson was arrested, tried, and convicted by one Judge Skinner, the amiable saloonkeeper did not hold a grudge. After the case was appealed and overturned in a higher court, he made sure to send over a large supply of liquor and cigars to Judge Skinner to be shared among all members of the lower court. After all, why let something like a little misdemeanor conviction come between two men of the world just doing their jobs? Prospects for Anderson, and for Storyville in general, improved significantly with the results of the municipal election of 1904. That year, a Ring stalwart named Martin Behrman from the Algiers district just across the river was elected mayor, and his attitude toward the city's vice industry was as accommodating as any sporting man could ask for. The ultimate anti-silk stocking, Behrman had little use for the high-minded moralizing of the Garden District elites, and he scoffed at their attempts to meddle in the serious business of running a big city. To Behrman, the typical silk stocking was the kind of citizen who always knew what had led to the fall of the Roman Empire, but did not seem to know that the bulk of the voters were more interested in schools, police, firemen, the charity hospital, the parks and squares, and labor troubles than the Roman Empire.